Hello, this is Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. You are listening to the Roundhouse Podcast. We have two guests today, and we're going to talk about some Shocker history. We're going to go back and construct some what-if scenarios, maybe some, I guess you could call it, this is our sliding doors episode. We have Mike Kennedy, voice of the Shockers, who would have witnessed many of these episodes that we're going to talk about. We have Bob Lutz, who also would have witnessed many of these. Mike, of course, is the voice of the Shockers. Bob wears many hats, most prominently, I guess, co-host of The Drive on KFH from 4 to 6 p.m. KFH is 1240 on your AM dial, 97.5. Also the grand poobah of League 42. First, give me your best book, TV show, something you've done to kill the time during the pandemic.
Well, I watched all 10 episodes of Ozark in one setting, one day. So that's my claim to fame during the pandemic, I guess.
Wow, Mike, top that.
You know, the one thing that I discovered, I haven't watched anything really, but I just stumbled onto something. I Googled 1957 was my first real season of being, you know, following Major League Baseball closely, and it turned out to be the last year of my Dodgers in Brooklyn. And that was the first year I played extensively on the Sandlot. So that year has always been special to me. And I Googled 1957 MLB and discovered there are a bunch of Brooklyn Dodger broadcasts, the entire broadcast out there, like on YouTube or whatever, with Vin Scully, Al Helfer, and Jerry Doggett. And so with no games to listen to, and I've been out working in the yard or whatever, I've been listening to those, and it's just been a hoot. It's been really, really fun. Extolling the virtues of Schaefer beer and Lucky Strike, best tasting cigarettes you've ever smoked. So
wow. Are those audio only or video also?
Yeah, audio only. On some of them they'll throw up some still pictures of the people involved, like Gil Hodges or Duke Snyder or whatever. But yeah, full real games.
Sure. Interesting stuff. All right. Let's get to number one. Our number one, what if, and this is
Mike had to top me.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Mike did some research. Yeah, definitely. All right. Number one.
I was sitting in front of my TV. Go ahead, Paul. I'm
sorry. Number one, this is one of my favorites. Bob wrote an article. I'm sure Mike is familiar with The Legend of Simi Hill also. Back in 2006, I think Mike did this story about Simi Hill, who was a basketball player, spent one season at Wichita State, and then departed, ended up at Junior College, West Texas State. Simi Hill passed away in 2013 at 66. So he played on that Shocker freshman team, scored 47 in his debut game against Independence Community College. He was academically ineligible, ended up at West Texas A&M, played there for two seasons, averaged 26 points, 11 rebounds, played four seasons in the ABA. Very talented kid from Midland, Pennsylvania, and he's been the subject of a lot of discussion among the people in that era. What would Shocker basketball have been in those late 60s had Simi Hill stuck around? Bob, you wrote the article. I'll let you get us started on the what if Simi Hill had played varsity basketball for Wichita State.
Well, there was a time when attending Shocker games meant attending freshman games that preceded Wichita State's varsity games. And the freshman games could be tremendously entertaining because Wichita State freshmen weren't eligible for the varsity. So you got to see the likes of all the greats. Warren Armstrong comes to mind particularly, but so does Simi Hill. He created a huge buzz among Shocker fans at that time. He was the next big thing, and for good reason. He was a tremendous player. But it didn't work out. So what would have happened? Well, the people from that era that I know, specifically Ron Mendel, who was a teammate, insists that Simi Hill would have put a pretty good 67-68. You'd have to give me the specific year. But whenever Simi Hill would have become eligible to play for the varsity, that he would have helped put that team, a good team, over the top to being a great team. And I have no reason to doubt that. I mean, he was a fantastic player.
Yes, the story you did back in 06 has this great Ron Mendel quote where he cautions against using too much hyperbole and then goes into comparing Simi Hill to Xavier McDaniel, Antoine Carr, and Dave Stallworth. So, yes, the people that saw Simi Hill thought he was really, really a special talent. Mike, what have you heard about the Simi Hill saga at Wichita State?
Well, first of all, I was a senior in high school the year that he arrived, the year after the Shockers had gone to the Final Four. So certainly I had seen Dave Stallworth play. He had just left at the semester the year before. And my first view of Simi Hill was they used to have an annual varsity freshman game. That kind of started the year off. It was, you know, an exhibition. But it was a full game type situation, you know, full clock, uniforms, the whole thing, 40-minute game. And he was tremendous against a very good varsity team that went, I think, 17-10, went to the NIT that year with Warren Armstrong and Velvet Reed and Jamie Thompson. This would have been 65-66. So you could see right away what a great player he was. I might mention, you said Ron Mendel wanting to avoid hyperbole. Ron Mendel's not a guy that gets real effusive with praise about things. So for him to say what he did about Simi, I think just echoes what everyone saw in him, that he had a chance to be comparable to a Dave Stallworth. And so when you ask about what it would have meant to those teams, that team was 17-10. I think the next year they were about 500 with Warren Armstrong and Ron Washington and so forth. Jamie Thompson and Melvin Reed would have been his teammates for a year. So I don't think there's any doubt that adding that inside presence that they didn't have, Melvin Reed had to play center at 6'5". Adding a presence like that inside and a tremendous talent like that, those would have been very good, possibly nationally ranked teams, certainly NIT, maybe NCAA caliber teams.
Yes. Well, just the thought of Simi joining Warren Armstrong and Jamie Thompson and Melvin Reed and later some of the people you mentioned, that's a heck of a roster, and they needed a big guy, and Simi would have alleviated that need.
Ron Mendel would have been a classmate of Simi Hill's. He would have been a freshman on that 65-66 team, and then Ron was a sophomore on that 66-67 team that Simi Hill did not play on. Just to clear up the timeline for those who were not around. So, yeah, that 65-66 team without Hill, with Hill as a freshman, went 17-10, played in the NIT. The 66-67 Shockers went 14-12. They were 9-5 in the Valley. The great Warren Armstrong was a junior. Jamie Thompson and Melvin Reed were the seniors. That's the team that, you know, that needed a big man, and Simi Hill was supposed to have been that guy. That team beat number 10 Bradley. They beat number 2 Louisville. They beat a Utah State team that played in the NIT. Kind of interesting. They lost to Southern Illinois, which was not a Valley team then, but that was the Walt Frazier team that went on to win the NIT in 67. So certainly he was, Simi Hill would have fit in perfectly with that group. I always thought the most, you know, Bob's article, the most fascinating, or one of the most fascinating things, was he came on a visit here with Norm Van Leer, and they were Wichita State. Gary Thompson, the coach at the time, was told you can take one of them, because they were both, I guess, kind of academically borderline. You can take one, you can't take them both, and they ended up choosing Simi Hill, and Norm Van Leer, you know, went on to have a fabulous NBA career. So that's kind of an interesting nugget. Bob dug up in that story. Okay, anything else?
Yeah, that's a great story. I'd recommend everybody, since you mentioned you're going to have a link to that, everyone read that, because it really has. And again, I think confirms other people's views of him besides Ron Mendel. I noticed in the article it mentioned that Dee Ketchum, who was the coach at Independence Community College, said he was the best player he had ever seen. Dee Ketchum played at KU with guys like Bill Bridges and Wayne Hightower, and I think was a freshman when Chamberlain was there. So that's quite a statement from a guy that had seen that kind of talent.
Simi Hill, quite an episode, and one that probably a lot of Shocker fans are not aware of. I would recommend that you go back and read that story. Pretty interesting.
Now, I will mention my other personal connection with this story is that some guys that I went to high school with that were a year older than I was were freshmen that same year, and had classes that Simi was supposed to be in, and they said they didn't see him very often. And when he was there, he usually was following the class with his from the inside of his eyelids. So that's where he ran into problems, I'm afraid.
Yes, that was unfortunate. All right, another huge what if, probably even bigger than Simi Hill, I guess, because this was more of a real thing. We can combine the 1964 and 1965 NCAA tournaments. In 64, what if guard Ernie Moore is eligible to play in the NCAAs? And then a year later, you had a similarly crucial what if Dave Stallworth and Nate Eligible are in uniform for the 1965 NCAAs. Let me give the people some quick background. Ernie Moore did not play in the 1964 NCAAs because of the three-season rule, which is something that wouldn't happen today. He had to sit out earlier in his career. The Missouri Valley Conference allowed him to play during the 63-64 season. Wichita State apparently thought that meant he would be eligible for the NCAA tournament, but that was turned down. Then we go to the next year. Dave Stallworth ran out of eligibility at the Christmas break in 64-65 because he had started a second semester earlier in his career. And then Nate Bowman became academically ineligible around the same time. So neither of those players played in the 1964 NCAA tournament, in which the Shockers, they advanced to the Final Four without him. But then lost to Bradley and Princeton. And I will turn the floor over to Mike at the first point. Two big what ifs. How might things have been differently with a little different eligibility luck?
Well, to follow up on what you just said, first of all, so current fans will understand the way the rules were back then. You still had 5 years to play for, like you do now, but it was broken up into individual semesters, and grades were reviewed at the end of each semester. So you'd see a lot of occasions where somebody would play the first semester of a season and then hadn't completed enough classes or their grades weren't good enough, and they suddenly became eligible in the middle of the year. And that's what had happened with Ernie Moore in his sophomore year. And so when he got to his fifth year, he had one semester left, and Leonard Kelly had entered the same semester that Dave Stallworth did a couple of years earlier. He had one semester left. So in that 63-64 season, Leonard played the first semester, Ernie played the second semester. They were both guards. And the NCAA had a rule back then, if you were a fifth-year player, whether it was for injury or academics or whatever reason, you were in your fifth year, you were eligible to play that year or that semester, but you could not play in the NCAA tournament. Cincinnati in 58-59 went to the Final Four but didn't have their senior point guard, Mike Mendenhall, who'd missed a year with an injury and was a fifth-year guy. So it happened to people, and Ernie was huge to that team. He was a tremendous player. He was instrumental in the win over Drake in the one-game playoff for the Valley title up in Lawrence after they had tied. So I don't think there's any question with him in the lineup that Wichita State had a great chance to get to the Final Four that year and maybe win it all.
Yeah, I've often said that I was an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid at the time, so my opinions on this came later as a journalist. Watching those teams as a kid, it was a wide-eyed experience. Ernie Moore was a fantastic player, one of the greats in Shocker history. With him in that lineup in the 1963-64 postseason, I believe they would have won a national championship because he was that good and his supporting cast was that good. And the next year, I don't know if we're going to get to the next year when these same issues affected Dave Stallworth, but it would not have been a huge stretch, see if Mike agrees with me, that they could have won back-to-back national championships. That's how good Ernie Moore and Dave Stallworth were, two of the best players in the country.
In 64, without Ernie, Wichita State lost to Kansas State in the regional final in Koch Arena on their home floor. And that was a very good K-State team, but they played maybe their best game of the season in that game. And I had seen them play in person a couple of times that year. They were just on that night and didn't play nearly as well in the national semifinal and gave UCLA, which went on to win it, a heck of a game right up to the end. So I really do believe with Ernie Moore, or even if the Shockers had gone on without Ernie Moore, I think they had a shot to beat UCLA. UCLA was a small team that year. Their center was Fred Slaughter from Topeka, who was 6'5". They had that press, and they were quick, but they lacked size. And I think Wichita State, with Bowman and Stallworth in that lineup, would have had a great chance to beat them. And then, as you say, Bob, the next year they made the Final Four without those guys in the lineup. You have to think that they would have had a real shot to win it that year as well. I don't think it's any stretch to say they could have won back-to-back national titles.
Certainly back-to-back Final Fours would have been a nice piece on the Shocker resume. That 64 team, they beat Creighton in the first round of the NCAAs and then lost to Kansas State, as Mike said. That next year in 65, the Shockers went up to Ahern Fieldhouse, beat Southern Methodist, beat Oklahoma State in the regional final, the famous game where all five starters played the entire game, and then went to Portland for the Final Four, where they lost to UCLA and lost to Princeton. Let's go to baseball. This is a painful one. Now you're getting into, I remember witnessing this. This might be back-to-back, two of the most frustrating days in Shocker baseball history. So the question, what if pitcher David Haas gets that one strike in the 1988 College World Series against Arizona State? Do the Shockers win back-to-back titles? Let me set it up here. Shockers up in Omaha, they led Arizona State 3-1 with two outs in the ninth. Haas, who was an excellent pitcher, pitched the whole game up to that point, went on to pitch in the major leagues. Twice he had an 0-2 count on the batters. Sun Devils singled three times. They tied it and then won it 4-3 in the 10th. So instead of advancing to the championship game versus Stanford, as the tournament's lone unbeaten, which was an important point back then. Back then it was a double elimination game, and Wichita State would have been the only team with no losses. The Shockers then had to play Arizona State again the next day, lost 19-1. Stanford defeated Arizona State 9-4 in the title game. Mike, I'll let you go first on that. What if David Haas gets that strike? Or what if Jim Newland comes in out of the bullpen?
They didn't need Jim Newland at that point because, I mean, Haas all but had one. Ricky Candelari is the one that I will never forget. He had two strikes on him. He fouled off two or three pitches, and on one of them, the bat literally left his hands. I'm not exaggerating. The pitch was outside, off the plate. Candelaria committed on it, reached for it, and had to let go of the bat. I mean, the bat came out of his hands and managed to make contact with the ball and foul it off. And then he ended up getting one of those singles that you mentioned. That's like one of the most surreal things I've ever witnessed. And then to follow it up the next day with a 19-1 loss, as long as I live, I'll never be able to reconcile that actually happened, that's a real thing. It was just absolutely unbelievable. And as you said, maybe the most frustrating, I don't think there's any question that's the most frustrating 2 days in the history of Shocker baseball.
Do they win?
It has to be because David Haas was a bulldog. You think when you get 0-2 on a hitter and you've got David Haas's stuff and tenacity, you can't even fathom the likelihood that he's going to give up two consecutive hits that tie the game. So unfathomable, and then to lose it in extra innings, and then to come back the next day, as Mike said, I think most people thought that the Shockers would come out with even more resolve, given the makeup of that team and that coaching staff, and to lose 19-1 was surreal.
They had to just have been devastated. Yes.
As far as whether they would have got to win that game if they had gone on to win it all, you know, that's a tough one. I'm sure that Gene and Brent and Lauren Hibbs would tell you, yeah, that they would have. And I think certainly it's at least a 50-50 proposition that they would have. That Stanford team that won it ended up having the worst record overall percentage-wise of any team that had ever won the College World Series. But they had gotten hot right there at the end of the year. There were several future major leaguers on that team. But I think certainly one issue would have been Wichita State would have been better rested and maybe had a little more pitching depth available going to a championship game had they won that that first game with Arizona State, and I had to play on the Friday before the championship game. So I think it's certainly reasonable to think that that Wichita State would have had a great chance at winning it all that year.
I did talk to Brent Chemnitz. He said the plan would have been, in his memory, Shockers would have had Greg Brummett for the title game that did not happen. He would have been, as you mentioned, he would have been rested. And then Stanford would have had to beat them twice, correct?
Right.
No, that was a I think first or second year, maybe second year, that they had gone to the format where you had the two brackets, and you did, it was a double elimination in the brackets, but then it was a one game championship on that Saturday for purposes of CBS television. So it was a one game championship situation. For instance, in 89, the Shockers had lost once in their bracket, but Texas was undefeated going into the championship. The Shockers only had to beat them that one time.
Let's say the Shockers win it in 88. How does that affect 89 in your minds?
You know, what's interesting about that is everyone you talk to on that 89 team was really fueled from the beginning by the frustration of that previous year. That had sent them on a mission coming into that season that played on again. So who knows if they hadn't lost that game or those games in 88, if it would have been quite the same feel, although as Bob mentioned, the makeup of those teams, the tenacity of the coaching staff and the players, you got Eric Wedge and people like that. I don't think it would have changed much, but you just never know how that little bit of extra edge might have made the difference.
Next question.
And Mike would have a better, I did not cover that team, so Mike would have a better recollection. David Haas had pitched tremendously well, no question. I would wonder, with Jim Newlin ready to go after the first hit made it 3-2, Mike, was there any discussion at that point of maybe going to Newlin for one out?
Gene said afterward that he probably should have made a change by the last hitter that came up after there had been a couple of base hits. But you didn't have the feel watching that game that David was tired or losing it. His stuff still seemed good. So and he said, no, it wasn't Gene's fault for not making a change. I should have gotten the out. But that was, that's how he was. But no, just watching, you didn't have the feeling he was losing it or tired. So to me, it's kind of a second guess to think they should have made a change there.
In the story from the Omaha World Herald, they describe, I guess it's now 3-2 after one of the singles. Gene went out to the mound to talk with Haas and Wedge. They were facing Pat Listash, and Haas had struck out Listash three times, all three of his previous at-bats. And then got up 0-2 on him, and Listash singled. And I don't think that, my understanding, Jim Newlin of that year was not Jim Newlin of 89. He was very good.
Quite.
He was not the lights out guy that he was a year later. So that would be part of the calculus as well.
Yeah, that's correct also, Paul. He was very good, but if it had been the Jim Newlin of 89, then I don't think there would have been any question. But he was as good as he wasn't anything like he was a year later.
All right, let's move to football. Here's a big one. We go back to 1986, Shocker football's struggling along, losing money, not a tremendous amount of success or fan support, so they drop it. At that point, they could have kept football. They could have dropped down to NCAA Division I AA. This has been the source of a lot of discussion over the years. Right now we're at a point where Wichita State's athletic department has been really, really successful for the last 20 years or so. How might things look different if Wichita State had made a different decision on football?
Well, that's 34 years ago now, which is almost hard to believe. I've gone back and forth about 34 times about this issue. I don't think it's logical to fault Wichita State for the decision at the time, but it was a very sad day when Wichita State dropped football, and there's still so many people who played at Wichita State that still have a love for that football program. And you think back just a few years before that, They had actually had a pretty good football team with Prince McJunkins and some other people that made that a very entertaining football product. So I guess the way I feel about it is a lot of ambivalence. It's very hard for me to put it all together. I feel extremely disappointed and sad on one hand, but I completely understand on the other.
I agree, Bob, and I, you know, there are people that have become very good friends that are among those former players, and I understand how they feel about it. But you know, the thing that struck me at the time, even and I felt this way when the announcement was made, as surprised to some extent and disappointed as I was, I certainly also understood the thinking behind it. Attendance was not very good. What they had tried to do was play catch up. Wichita State was kind of behind the times when college football made a big move in the, say, the late 60s, early 70s toward, you know, building massive weight rooms, adding staff, all that sort of thing. And Wichita State had tried to make a commitment to not only hiring a head coach at a competitive salary, but adding staff. But all of that they were doing was adding to what they were spending on football, and the athletic department was getting deeper and deeper in debt. And my question, given the turnout for Shocker football, was even if they had dropped at the time to 1AA, and let's say they were playing Arkansas State for the number one ranking in the nation in 1AA, if they would have drawn more than 10 or 12,000 people, because there was a feeling to me that where, you know, baseball had really taken off and established itself nationally, the basketball program was still at a high national level, that the perception of football, even though it was 1A at the time, was that it was just a lower level. I'm talking about fan reaction and fan perspective. It was just a different level than even KU or K-State, and that there just wasn't the kind of interest to sustain it. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm 100% right about that, but I certainly understand why that decision was made.
And I agree. And I think the most infamous game maybe in Wichita State history was a loss to Morehead State. And I know Mike remembers it. They jumped out to a big lead against an inferior opponent, and they lost that game due to a huge comeback by Morehead State, but also a huge choke job by the Shockers, frankly. And that game was very fresh in the minds of a lot of people at that time, and I think it signified the beginning of the end in many ways. And it was a bad product that Wichita State was putting on the field at that time, and nobody wanted to see it, and nobody wanted to support it, and that's why the decision to drop football was understandable.
You know, it was weird. If you were around the program, you almost felt like it was cursed in some ways. And the game you just mentioned, Bob, is a perfect example. Pretty sure the score was 35-0. And Morehead State came all the way back and with just almost no time left scored to make it 35-34. And they went for the extra point, you know, kicked the extra point to tie, because their coach said at the time, "I just didn't have the heart to have our kids come that far back and then end up losing." But Wichita State jumped off sides on the extra point, which moved the ball to the 1.5. And then they decided to go for two and got the 2-point conversion and won the game. And that was just the kind of stuff that seemed to happen to the Shocker football program.
All right, we've got 8 minutes left in our Zoom period, so we're going to go lightning round with these next, with the final three. 2014, we will bring this into the current day for all the listeners who are not ancient like ourselves. Great 2014 basketball team. What if they had been a number one seed in one of the other regions and not run into that NBA heavy Kentucky team in the second round? What happens then?
Well, I think it would have been fun. Go ahead, Mike. But my quick reaction to that is that Shocker team could have easily beaten Kentucky. And yes, Kentucky was certainly better than an eighth seed. But Wichita State was competitive with any team in the country. So, yeah, different region, who knows?
Anything could have happened. Not only was that a really talented Kentucky team, but their people around them all felt like that was the best game they had played all year. And Wichita State, of course, played at a very high level, too, and that Kentucky team went on to the Final Four. So there's no reason to think that that Shocker team couldn't have or wouldn't have. It's just even maybe Kentucky on a different day, and the Shockers might have advanced.
Yeah, I think, after starting covering Wichita State in 2005, out of all the, regrets or disappointments, that might be number one in the fact just that we didn't get to see that team play more high-level games in great atmospheres.
But we did get to see one of the great games in Shocker history. Even though they lost it, that was a scintillating, exciting game in which both teams played at an extremely high level.
No question. And I know, as Greg Marshall said several times, they in some ways gained a lot of respect, more respect coming out of that loss than they had out of any of their 35 previous wins. So it was an odd situation. I would have loved for that 2014 team to get a couple more chances to play basketball.
Let me say just real quickly, but that's just one of the interesting things about the NCAA tournament. When Al McGuire finally won it with Marquette in 1977, after he announced that he was retiring at the end of the year, he said he'd had three or four or five better teams in his tenure there than the one that won it. Sometimes it's just about the right matchups or the right day, luck, whatever you want to call it. It definitely plays in.
Let's go back to the start of the 2001-02 basketball season. Freshman center Paul Miller, three games in, breaks his foot, redshirts that year. Then he comes back the next year. Shockers go NIT, 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 and then in 2006, he is Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year. Shockers go to the Sweet 16. How did his broken foot play into the history of that era of Shocker basketball?
Well, there was Jamar Howard, Randy Burns, Rob Campman, and Paul that were all freshmen that same year. And so it would have been, if he had stayed healthy, it would have been a very young group that progressed together. But he was a big part of the 04-05 team, and they ended up in another NIT. So I think him having that extra year of physical maturity, experience, and so forth, made all the difference in Wichita State finally getting back to the NCAA in 06. I think that it ended up being a fortuitous injury both for him and for the program that he did have that extra year.
Couldn't agree more. Paul Miller turned into a very, very good basketball player. He was not that at the time of his injury. So I think the injury not only helped Wichita State, but helped Paul with another opportunity to develop his game, and he did that.
We may have some firm resolution on this question. Out of all of them, this may be the one. I think there's no doubt that he was really helped by that redshirt year and just was fabulous as a senior in 05-06. All right, let's knock out the last one here. Mid-90s, Koch Arena, Leavitt Arena then is in decline. They've kind of fallen behind in a lot of areas, both in the arena and the academic, the offices. There was talk of let's build a downtown arena. Let's move Shocker basketball down there. The basketball program needs it. The city needs it. What if Wichita State had thrown its full weight behind a proposed downtown arena in the mid-1990s and moved down there? How does that change things?
Well, it doesn't change if Mike Cohen's coaching the team. They could have played in the Palace of Auburn Hills, and it wouldn't have mattered. Listen, Koch Arena is a perfect venue for Wichita State basketball. I love the fact that they play an annual game downtown. I think it's great. In other circumstances, playing downtown has some appeal to me. But the fact that Koch Arena has all this history is tremendous. But I don't think moving that program anywhere with the coaching situation that existed. Now, later, we had Scott Thompson come in, who we all thought was going to be a successful coach. I remember sitting around with Mike and others and thinking that, wow, they were able to get Scott Thompson. That's going to turn this thing around. Well, it didn't, and it took several more years. But I don't think a move downtown would have helped the program at that point.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Paul, the other facilities. I think that all of that stuff needed to improve, and so what they did with the training room and the academic facilities and so forth was important piece of it. But if you just had that on campus and then you go downtown to play your games, I don't know that it's as good a recruiting tool as having the whole thing there. And they did such a good job with the renovation of maintaining some of the atmosphere and the closeness of the fans to the court. I don't think you could have recreated that in a new arena downtown. So I think they really did get the best of all possible worlds by doing it the way they did. And it remains one of the best arenas and best home court situations in all of college basketball.
In retrospect, yes, had you moved downtown in 1995 or 96, you still would have had issues with Levitt Arena. That still would have needed to have been upgraded in a lot of ways. So I think they did exactly the right thing there in the early 2000s when they renovated the arena. All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. We're about to run out of time here. So Mike, Bob, thanks very much for your perspective. Been very interesting for the fans out there. Thanks for listening to the Roundhouse podcast. We appreciate it. Stay safe.